Chatter on Books. It's Cliff Notes for book clubs. Why read the book if you can listen to Chatter on Books? I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer, but you don't care about that. Here again is your host, Tori Clark.
Welcome back to Chatter on Books. Hope you're doing well, staying healthy. Right now, we have the award-winning Claude Jennings sucking down some Gatorade, Claude.
Yeah.
Jennings doing all the important work. David is back from Cleveland, and Jamie McIntyre is with us. Welcome back. And in just a few minutes, we're going to be talking to an author named Lee Kravitz. And I have so many questions for Lee and about his wonderful book, The Last Confessions of Sylvia P. And I promise to get to lots of questions about the book. We all will. But I have so many questions for Lee because he has a really interesting background. But first, kind of a quick catch up. A note of seriousness. I don't think you can start a day or end a day and not think about what's going on in Ukraine. And David and I traded a few texts earlier today. And Jamie, I want you to give us the geopolitical take in a minute. But David, talk to us about what's going on in the world of sports, athletes, and nations in terms of how what's going on in Ukraine is affecting them and affecting sports across the board.
Well, I would say it certainly depends on the sport, right? I mean, there are some sports, you know, the NBA and Major League Baseball and NFL aren't particularly affected by this. They don't play games in Russia for the most part. They have very few Russian or Ukrainian born players. There are a handful. There are a couple of NBA players who are from Ukraine. The issue starts to develop with the WNBA and women's basketball because I think people know this, but in case you don't, you know, the salaries that women players have been paid in the WNBA have not been nearly enough to subsist on. So a lot of players, I would say the majority of WNBA players also play abroad,
right?
In their off season, quote unquote, with the WNBA. And that includes players that have played in Russia, that have played for Russian teams, for multiple Russian teams over the years. And just this past weekend, we saw that Brittany Griner, who was a superstar in the WNBA, she won a national championship at Baylor. She's plays for the Phoenix Mercury. She's one of the best players in the world, is currently detained in Russia because she brought vaping equipment with her, which, you know, in America would not even, no one would bat an eye, but it's considered a major crime in the Soviet Union and in Russia, I should say. Yeah. And there have been athletes in other sports who have spent months in prison before they were let go. So this is a serious deal.
Yeah. And the impacts, again, on individual athletes. So I saw a Russian tennis player.
Yes.
And a Ukrainian tennis player who was in Mexico, I think, playing in a tournament. And he says, I'm going back to Ukraine. And if I need to fight, I will fight. I mean, some of the sacrifices these people are making. But the things like Brittany Griner, it gets complicated so quickly because, David, aren't most of the Russian the Russian women's teams owned by these oligarchs?
Many of them are, yes. Yeah. Not all of them, but many of them are, yes. And that certainly complicates matters, and that extends to some of the other sports teams, soccer teams. We see one of the most famous soccer teams in the world is owned by a Russian oligarch who now is saying, yes, he's going to sell the team.
Yeah.
So the implications, especially – in Europe for European sports leagues are profound. And I don't know that there is no easy solution to these issues. And the other sport, of course, is the NHL. I mean, it's a very, very
huge,
dicey situation. It's very, and I don't, it's not that I feel bad for a player like Alex Ovechkin. I don't, but I understand that that's a very complicated thing for him to talk about and to talk about intelligently, I think, more than anything else. And,
right.
And it's a difficult thing and it's nuanced and he's not, that's not his world. You know, his world is not the world of diplomacy and politics. He's a hockey player, you know?
Okay. I'll push back on you slightly on that. And as most people know, my family all in on the Caps.
Yeah.
And without going into any details that we talked about before the show, up until recently, we would compartmentalize Alex Ovechkin and his relationship with Putin, his personal, significant relationship with Putin. and a relationship that he embraced and a relationship that he published.
Absolutely. Yes, he did.
So I agree with you. You know, athletes should not be forced to be politicians. They should not be forced to comment on every social issue. Yeah. But he's put himself into that arena.
No question.
And then to just say, yeah, it's not my job. You know, I find that a little disappointing myself. But to your point, really complicated. My understanding, and his wife, his parents, his kids happen to be in Russia right now.
Well, that
makes
it
very difficult.
Yes, it's an incredibly complicating, factor in this. Is that he's still got a lot of family in Russia.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be good, I don't think, for them if he starts, saying, Putin's is a dictator and a murderer and a bad person and he should stop this war and I'm siding with Ukraine. Not, I don't think what that family would want to hear right now.
Right.
If you're sitting in Russia.
What do you, it's unfair to put you on the spot, but I will anyways, should the NHL do? When you think about the freaking IOC, for God's sake, and FIFA and others saying, okay, we're not going to have any big events in Russia. Athletes are going to be banned for the time being, et cetera.
Yeah.
What should the NHL do?
Well, it'll be interesting to see what they do. They do have I'm certainly an expert in hockey, but I know that they have a very big international tournament that's supposed to be in St. Petersburg either later this year or in 2023. And it's a fairly big tournament. And it's I don't know if it's the world championships, but it's akin to that level of tournament. And that's what a lot of people are waiting to see. What are they going to do? Are they going to pull that tournament out of St. Petersburg? Because that would be a big deal. It would be a big loss for Russia if they do that. The NHL, there's a number of players, I don't know what the percentage is, but it's a lot of Russian born players, lots of them in the NHL, not just Ovechkin, Malkin, and some of the other superstars in the NHL are Russian players. And it's not easy. It's not easy for them. It's easy for us because we don't have any skin in the game. They've got people on the ground that whose lives could be impacted by what they say. And that I think we have to be realistic about that. And it doesn't mean that it wouldn't be great if they spoke it with one voice or if one or two of them spoke out and were very, aggressive in their condemnation, as we would all hope they would be. I'm just saying, I get that it's not as easy for them as we think it is for them to speak out at this particular moment.
As we want it to be. Okay, Jamie McIntyre, put on your smart national security geopolitical hat. I think if anyone 10 days ago had said Ukraine's going to hold on and Russia won't just march in there and take over the country quickly, we would have been laughed at. But they're hanging on.
Of course, you and I were at the Pentagon in 2003.
We were.
When the United States invaded Iraq in a campaign that some people had dubbed shock and awe. I don't know whether the Pentagon ever actually used that term, but
no.
And the Russians, we were told, went to school on that campaign, which was textbook, 8 days after the beginning of the invasion, the statue of Saddam was toppled in Tahrir Square in Baghdad. And initially, as you may recall, a lot of people have forgotten this, we were actually greeted as liberators there. But there's a completely different kind of shock and awe going on in Ukraine, which is widespread shock by U.S., former military commanders and the Pentagon, for that matter, at how inept and amateurish the Russian military is. It has an all conscript army, and most of them didn't even know they were going to be invading Ukraine. They don't want to be invading Ukraine. There's been instances of troops not following orders, walking away. When they do go in to confront the Ukrainian forces, they get massacred on the ground. It's a shock at how bad the Russian military is and awe of the courageous and creative tenacious defense launched by the Ukrainians. Now, that said, the Russians do have a tremendous amount of combat firepower, and what Putin has done to compensate for the fact that his ground forces are so disconnected. They don't seem to have any idea how to conduct maneuver warfare at all in the classic American sense.
Right.
So he's undergone this, he's undertaken this terrible, brutal campaign of shelling and missiles and long range things to just try to bomb people into submission. It's created this, you know, tidal wave of human misery in Ukraine. 1.5 or 1.7 million people who are now refugees trying to get out of the country. It's brutal. It's cruel. It's a war crime. It follows no sort of military doctrine that we would. And then tellingly, the Pentagon confirmed today that that Russia has been bringing in foreign fighters, the so-called, you know, like shock troops, who are troops that would actually follow Putin's orders and conduct atrocities and stuff that some of the average Russian troops just weren't prepared to do. So now we find ourselves, approaching 2 weeks into the campaign, and Ukraine is holding on. They are paying a terrible price, the country, in the destruction of beautiful cities and the misery of the civilians. I mean, it's just heart-wrenching to watch what's going on there. But the reality is, the longer they can hold out, if they can hold out, the more the Russian campaign is likely to falter. No, as you said, no one thought Ukraine would be able to stand up to the might of the, you know, Russian military, but it's turned out to be as I referred to it in one of my articles, a Potemkin army, a paper tiger. And it's and because of that, he's resulted to these just cruel, scorched earth, campaign, which is indiscriminately bombing schools and hospitals and residential neighborhoods. It's just terrible. And, you know, the big difference, of course, between what happened in 2003 with Iraq, or even in 1991, when, you know, George Bush famously said, "This will not stand," when Saddam Hussein rolled his tapes his tanks into Kuwait and said, mm-hmm. "This is the 19th province of Iraq," is that Putin is sitting on an arsenal of nuclear weapons, and he keeps threatening to use
them. Makes a big difference.
And we don't think he's stable enough not to use them. Russia has a specific doctrine of using what they refer to as tactical or battlefield nuclear weapons, a small nuclear weapon, to end, if they're losing a conventional war, their doctrine calls for using small nuclear weapons and then basically daring the other side to respond. It's called escalate to de-escalate. It's right in their doctrine. So when Putin threatens, you know, the equivalent of fire and fury, if anybody interferes, we kind of have to take that seriously. So it's that's where we are. And if I could just say one more thing about,
of course,
you know, about the, I think it's really important that we don't label people who are Russian for Russian ancestry as necessarily, you know, the bad guys in this, because just because you're Russian or you have Russian heritage doesn't mean you're sympathetic to Putin. It does, even if you say something supportive of Putin, doesn't mean you're necessarily supportive of Putin. You may be afraid for the security of your family. I think we need to be careful when we look at what, you know, and that we don't demonize people who are Russian, because there are many Russians, including those in Russia, who are supportive of Ukraine. And the other lesson we're seeing from this is that propaganda, if you control all the media, can work, because a large percentage of people in Russia do believe that somehow this was provoked by Ukraine and that they really were a threat and that Russia had no choice but to go in.
Yeah, we know. I saw an amazing interview the other day of the young Ukrainian woman with her small children. She's made it into Poland, and her mother, her parents are still in Russia, and her mother does not believe her. Okay, I find it absolutely fascinating. We could go on forever. I promise we won't, because this show is ostensibly about books. But one of these that gives, I'm always looking for the pony in there, and I'm always looking for something to be hopeful about. And as awful as it is, and the tragedy of what is going on for those poor people is terrible. But a really big strategic mistake Putin has made was it never occurred to him that this would strengthen NATO, commitment to NATO. This would strengthen the EU. This would strengthen a commitment to democracy, for God's sake, which was not exactly foremost in a lot of people's minds. So I have this horrible feeling he may win a battle, that battle being Ukraine, but I think the war may be different. Okay, should we pretend that the show is about books?
Yes.
Let's do it.
Okay.
Yes. Do you have author standing by in the wings?
He's left by now.
He's riveted. I'm riveted to this. Fascinating, guys.
All right. I've got two and a half very quick things. I have to do a Dolly Parton update, and I will, this time next week, hopefully, I will be in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. Wow. And Dollywood. Nice. The book that Dolly and James Patterson have done together is Gangbusters, the 7 songs that she wrote overnight to go along with the book, going gangbusters. So we're very happy for the goddess Dolly Parton.
If you get a picture with Dolly Parton, I am going to just plot.
I would just die. It's going to happen. Before I die, David, it's going to happen. It'll be
Dolly
one,
Parton
of those
is one of the most amazing, amazingly talented people as a business woman, as a songwriter, as a performer, as a humanitarian. I mean, what's not to like about Dolly Parton?
Nothing. As an employer, and we'll bring it back to Jamie. As an employer, we talked about this, I think, Jamie, when you were on the show at Dollywood, where I will be a week from today, in case you're remembering. If you're an employee, if you've been an employee for 10 years or one day, if you are full-time or part-time, full tuition, books, expenses, etc., for educational opportunities. She's the best. And I think we're up to about 175 million books she has given away for free for kids. Love Dolly. Okay, it was a really hard segue from Ukraine to Dolly. This is slightly easier. The Dr. Seuss estate. So some months ago, we talk a lot, at least Lee, our author, is kind of paying attention to what we're talking about here. We talk a lot about idiots who want to ban books and censor books and all that. Yeah. And some time ago, the Dr. Seuss estate, on their own, pulled some of the books from the shelves and said, we don't think, in light of where we are in the 21st century, these are appropriate, because of the way they characterize certain people of certain colors, certain genders, et cetera. So the estate has now announced that they're going to be creating some Dr. Seuss-inspired books, and they're going to tap into a variety of authors and illustrators that they hopefully draw from every size, shape, color, ethnicity, et cetera, mm-hmm. to create these books. David, because we might lose you soon, what do you think?
I love this idea, and I was thinking, are you familiar with Mo Rocca? Do you know who he is?
Mm-hmm. Love Mo Rocca.
Okay, he's on Sunday Morning, and he's a satirist.
Yeah,
I would love for him to be an author of one of these books. I think he would write a really funny, kind of offbeat book. And then there's this other wonderful young writer and producer who, I don't know if you've watched this new show, Abbott Elementary, that's on ABC.
I know of it.
It's hysterically funny. It's about the teachers and the administrators at this kind of urban high school. Yeah. And it's just a great, it's a comedy. But yeah. Quinta Brunson is the young lady that's put this together. And she's one of the leads. And it's her show. It's her idea. And it's just the dialogue in this show is just so smart and funny and brilliant. I would love to have her. That's another name I thought of. Those are two people I thought of. I'd love to see them write the books.
Jamie McIntyre, your grandchildren, will you buy new Dr. Seuss-inspired books?
Okay, so in theory, I think this is a great idea. Something about trying to sort of perpetuate or extend what is a great, canon of work by Dr. Seuss. I kind of feel like we have great Dr. Seuss books. Do we need to do more? I mean, I guess we're trying to just, capture the lightning in the bottle and keep it going. And this is a very creative idea where they're taking sketches that Dr. Seuss did, that some of them look like they were for books he never wrote.
Yeah.
And so imagining what that might suggest. And each author and illustrator will talk about why, what inspired them about it. So I think it's a really neat idea. There's part of me that thinks like, can we just create something completely original? But this will be completely original, inspired. by...
I'm trying to think of a parallel to something else in life, which I won't until about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'll text you. But I think this is great because I know how important Dr. Seuss books were to me when I was young. I mean, that was escape. That was fantasy. That was learning how to read, not in a grammatically correct fashion, but they were so important. And I think if you can bring that same magic, maybe you can't recreate magic. If you can bring that same magic to a rhyme.
Do we need more Winnie the Pooh books too? And more, I don't know, Alice in Wonderland extended stories?
Yes. Yes.
It's kind of like fan fiction in a way.
Well, I was going to say, talk about, books that are, extending legacy and extending readership. I mean, I think this works a lot better. I'd much rather have this happen than, say, another Cat in the Hat movie, which, doesn't really, it doesn't necessarily, draw on the spirit of Dr. Seuss in any way, but it just kind of sort of cashes in on his name. This sort of extends his legacy, brings people back to Dr. Seuss, and maybe we get something new out of it.
I agree completely. I'm looking forward to it.
So okay, good example is that was when they did the original animated version of How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
Right.
But a book that if you read it, maybe took 10 minutes and extended it and put songs and animation in it. And I thought they did a terrific job of sort of expanding on that. But once it started to get into the full length feature movie where you had to make it, 2 hours. I mean, the latest version of that was very cute. But I kind of felt like it began to lose. It's like sometimes things are perfect and they don't need to be made more perfect. Just my opinion.
I think this is an addition to perfection. Okay, that other voice you all just heard, Chatter listeners, was Lee Kravitz, who is our featured author this evening. Lee, welcome to Chatter on Books. Thanks for putting up with all our other discussions.
Oh my God, I'm so glad I crashed this early. This has been awesome, guys. It's been awesome. And David, I love listening to you. Jamie also. I mean, it's great to listen to you guys go back and forth. I think you guys are fantastic.
Thank you so much.
Well, it would be churlish of me to disagree with you. No, I'm just going to disagree.
Good.
Okay, Lee. So we've had many authors on the show with lots of different kinds of backgrounds. And yours is one of the most interesting because of your training and your education and your personal experience. So you trained as a counselor in psychology. Am I saying that correctly?
That's correct. Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. You went to the University of Missouri for journalism school.
That's right.
You've had your own personal battle with cancer, which is part of your inspiration.
Yeah.
But which of those things directed you to writing what we're about to talk about, which is The Last Confessions of Sylvia P?
Would you believe every single one of them?
Yeah, probably.
Every single one of them. I went to journalism school. I was going to be a journalist. I started out in feature writing and magazine writing and newspaper writing. I did it, honestly, my very first job, when I lived in Texas, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram was my city paper. And I was 14 years old and I told them I was 16 and I got a job. And I was writing for them when I was in middle school. And it went all the way through and it got me into journalism school. And
wow.
So that was an experience. And
who were your role models? Who were your journalistic role models? Was it Woody Bernstein? Was it David Aldridge?
all of you guys. It was great. But Carl Bernstein was, I have a great story about Carl Bernstein. I was 15 years old. He comes to town to give some sort of lecture. And my dad took me and it was a small room and I got to ask him one-on-one questions and I raised my hand and I said, Mr. Bernstein, I want to go to journalism school. I want to do just what you're doing. What would you recommend I do? Where do you think I should go? And he looks at me and he goes, don't go to journalism school. And in fact, my initial reaction was he's making fun of me, but he was absolutely right because cut to years later, I'm working in book publishing in New York. I worked at Penguin and Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Mm-hmm. And I was doing this because I wanted to be an author. I wanted to be a novelist more than anything. And the problem was, I was getting a great education. All my authors were marquee authors and they were teaching me everything as I was sort of editing their work and going through their work. But I didn't know how to write, or I knew how to write. I just didn't know what to write about. I'd gone to school to write, but I didn't have a subject matter. And so after I got sick, as you alluded to, I got better. And I was like, well, life is short. I should probably do something. If I'm not going to be able to get published, I should go and become a therapist. So I went to school with my master's to get my master's degree in psychology. And my first book turned out to be my dissertation. It was picked up by HarperCollins.
Wow.
And all of a sudden, my writing career kicked off. But before I did that, I was working in a mental hospital. I was doing my rotations at a mental hospital, and it happened to be the very same mental hospital that Ken Kesey worked at when he was writing One Flew Over the Cuckoo's
Nest. Wow.
Are you kidding?
The building was right next door. It had been shut down. It looked like a condemned building. And it was, if you've seen the movie, it looks just like that. But I was in the building next door, and it had been updated in the 70s. So it still had that orange sort of aesthetic and looked terrible. But when you walk into the mental hospital portion of it, there was a kiosk of books where the patients, you know, all you do is sort of shuffle around all day. And so I'm doing my rotations, and in the kiosk, there's the bell jar, and I picked it up. And that was the beginning of what became The Last Confessions of Sylvia P.
Okay, wait a minute. So many things. You're just going to be here for hours.
Yeah.
How many of the patients at the mental institution read The Bell Jar, and did they like it?
You know, it was in a kiosk that actually had a bunch of like sort of Stephen King novels and, you know, cop novels and sort of, nothing, there was not high literature there. So the fact that it was there at all was sort of surprising.
That might be one. We don't like censorship or banning books of any kind on the show.
Yeah.
That might be one where the administration might go, we really need to have this out there.
No, this is the VA. They don't pay that much attention. So, it was weird. I think somebody brought it in there and left it there. And it was sort of, it was sort of a gift, and it was certainly a gift to me because, you know, I'm sitting there rereading this book that I had read years ago. And it's like anybody who's read Sylvia Plath, you don't necessarily remember the first time you've heard her work, but she's always sort of been in your head in some way. Uh-huh. And so I'm reading it again, and I'm going through it, and I realize that it's actually not just telling the veiled story of Sylvia Plath. Because it's a memoir, it's a memoir, but it's a fictionalized sort of version.
Semi-autobiographical.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But you read it, and it's not just about her life. It's actually the parallel story of the birth of confessional poetry. And that to me was like light bulb moment. I was like, I want to tell this story about this type of poetry that was raw and authentic that had never been done before. And it did not come to fruition. It wasn't born in like a university or a town or a region. It was born in mental hospitals. Robert Lowell, Ann Sexton, Sylvia Plath were all hospitalized, and actually for the same reason, for they call it manic depression, but it was bipolar disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And they all had it. And they all went through the system, and they all came out and wound up in Boston, Massachusetts at the same time in the early 1960s. Our 50s and 60s.
Right.
And it became the confessional poetry movement. It changed everything.
Wow. This is amazing, Tori.
Aren't you learning stuff, David?
Of course. But again, this keeps coming up, Lee, in our discussions about books. These groups of people always wind up in the same place. It's unbelievable.
I know. I think that's where the magic happens. It is. You know that there's other people around and people kind of gravitate toward it. But in this case, this was absolutely right. And it just happened to be mental hospitals all within the Boston area, all around the same time. And they all start feeding off of each other. And it all actually, once they left the hospitals, it happened. They went to Boston University, where Robert Lowell had this very, very, very famous poetry workshop. And he wasn't teaching confessional poetry, but he was writing confessional poetry. And people all funneled through there and were like, we want to be like Robert Lowell. And if you look at the way that poetry changed as a result of this confluence of sort of artists all coming together, it changed everything forever forward. Poetry, literature, memoirs, rock and roll music, folk music, it all stems from this understanding that we can talk about the thoughts and feelings that we're not supposed to talk about and put it on the page. that was just, to me, was this beautiful, beautiful thing that all happened in one concentrated area, like you said.
That's wonderful. Okay, this is a wonderful segue to the book, The Last Confessions of Sylvia P. Jamie, please ask the Jamie question.
Bring it.
So I'm famous.
It's really hard, Lee. Get ready. This is.
I'm ready. I got my coffee.
So part of I think I asked this question on the first time I was on the show, and then I'm famous for it now. But so here's the question. Get ready.
I'm ready.
Lee, what is the book about?
I don't know.
And the reason I asked that is because often we get deep into the discussion of a book, and I realize, because I have to honestly confess, I haven't read the book, and I'm beginning to wonder,
yeah,
I should have read the fly leaf at least before we decided. But anyway, so what is the book about?
You know, it's great. Thank you for asking. That's a great question to ask. And I'll tell you, the book is about, so you know who Sylvia Plath is? Sylvia Plath is a poet and an author. She's a novelist. And she died when she was 30 years old by suicide. And the only book, the only novel that she ever wrote was called The Bell Jar. And so the Bell Jar has been a hugely influential novel ever since it was published. And to this day, it is like one of the number one bestsellers out there. It's still selling through the roof.
Yeah, it still shows up again and again and again.
It does. It's a classic for a reason. And so the novel really looks at three different women who encounter Sylvia Plath in different stages of Sylvia's life. And they both influence her, and she influences them on her way to writing The Bell Jar. And so you've got, you know, the story of Ruth Barnhouse, who is Sylvia Plath's psychiatrist at McLean Hospital when she shows up after having tried to kill herself the first time. And she can't read and she can't write. She's completely, you know, fallen apart. And Dr. Ruth Barnhouse uses innovative and new techniques to sort of reteach her how to read and to write. And that starts her on her journey to becoming the poet that we all know and love today. Then you, at the same time, you have the storyline of Boston Rhodes, who is a confessional poet, very ambitious, and is ostensibly going to be the queen of confessional poetry until Sylvia Plath shows up. And so there's a rivalry that sort of forms between them that pushes Sylvia toward greatness, but also to the brink. And then you have a modern storyline that takes place, well, today in Boston. There's an auction house that has come into what is possibly the first handwritten edition of The Bell Jar. And the person who is sort of trying to delve into what these manuscripts really are finds herself drawn into conspiracy and into the mystery of who Sylvia was. And of course, she has a connection to Sylvia herself.
Okay. So read the book, loved the book. And the last week or so, people say to me, and my kids say to me, who's on the show? What's it about? And I give them the shtick. And then I say, you know, it's mystery and it's history. And it's great writing. And I said, I can't not wait to meet this guy, Lee Kravitz, because he must be so gutsy. Because Lee, so much has been written about Sylvia Plath. So much has been written about her psychiatrist. So much has been about her husband. So much is written about her and everything and everyone around her. What gave you the moxie? I was thinking of another word, but I'll use another word.
You bring it. Right.
Word you were thinking of?
Yeah. Well, what gave you the moxie to take this on? And the course of the show, I've gotten to know some of the people at some of the publishing houses, and a topic like this, they would take so seriously. And I think they would question and challenge everything. But what gave you the moxie, or what was that drove you to say, I'm going to take on this topic and this woman?
Part of it was just complete ignorance. it really was.
Welcome to Chatter on Books, people. Complete ignorance. That's us.
You know what? And ignorance gets you far. I mean, that's really it. I fell in love with this story. I had a real passion for it. I knew from the minute I started working on it that there was something here to be said and done. But you're not alone in asking this question. A couple of interviewers have asked me how I, you know, gone from nonfiction to fiction. And the truth is, like, even my agent was really sort of not nervous about the subject, but sort of wondering if I could really pull this off. And the minute I turned it in, he sort of called me up and he was like, we need to talk. This can go all the way. So I knew once he sort of signed off on it that we were in the right place. I work really, really hard to try to understand, when I worked as a therapist, I worked really hard to sort of understand people and where they come from and see them in a way that most people don't. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I could do the same. If I could do the same for the people who were interacting with Sylvia, I might be able to explore a piece and a side of Sylvia Plath that nobody else has ever been able to do. All we have from Sylvia are letters and poems and not a single novel and some clips, but that's it. We don't really know who she is. And that's what makes her so interesting and what makes her so mysterious. But if I could sort of have three different stories sort of triangulating around her, it's sort of like blowing smoke in a room and having the outline of a person appear. That's what I wanted to do for Sylvia Plath. And the more I got into it, the more I realized what a three-dimensional human being she was, who was fragile and frail, completely misunderstood, and very, very human. I've never seen that done with her, ever.
Interesting. Okay, let's talk about Boston Rhodes for a minute, because she, of the three women... Okay, and look, two questions. The book is really seen through the eyes and the lives of these three women. You aren't a woman, as far as I can tell from looking at you.
Yeah, that is true.
What were there any special challenges? Did you feel disadvantaged in any sense?
You ask, again, a great question. And even my writing group was like, Lee, you can't write from the perspective of three women. And I said, you know, it's possible. I could botch this and I will be, you know, thrown to the ground, which I will admit that I screwed up. You know, in this case though, for some reason, it just sort of made sense. It made sense the way that, the story just sort of moved through me. Yeah. I have on my phone, a recording device, and it got to the point where I was actually, when I was getting into character and I would sort of dictate in Boston Rhodes' voice. I would dictate in Barnhouse and Ruth Barnhouse's voice and in Estee's voice, because it's sort of like becoming getting into character. And that's where all of their sort of mannerisms and all of their sort of the way that they speak and see the world sort of manifested through that. And there are therapeutic techniques, believe it or not, that are very similar to this. They're sort of the empty chair technique, which is, gestalt therapy, is all about projecting personalities into people who aren't there in the room with you and having conversations with them back and forth. So for me, it was almost therapeutic the way I was going at it. I never thought about them as women per se. I thought about them as people interacting with Sylvia.
Which is very healthy. Okay, so Boston, I was fascinated by her, and David, I know we're going to lose you in just a few, so I'll go to you first. But Boston truly believed, and she had reason to believe, that she was going to be the be-all, end-all.
Yeah.
And then Sylvia comes along and just blows it. So yeah. David, you first, and then Jamie, you both come from very competitive fields and industries, and you both have worked at the height of your fields. Have you ever experienced something like this where you think, okay, I'm working hard, I'm doing everything, and then some hotshot comes blowing in?
Course, all the time. All the time. Oh, sure. But you have to be secure enough to understand, like, you know, in my line of work, there was an author at Sports Illustrated who wrote their long form, their back of the book, their big 10,000 word feature story. Right. His name, Gary Smith. And when you read Gary Smith, I mean, it was very easy for me. I'll never be as good as this guy. This guy's right. You know what I mean? Like that. That's just easy. That wasn't even difficult for me. You know,
some it would be difficult.
Yeah, I guess it would be. But when you know how hard it is to write, and you read somebody and you go, God, this is so good. This is so good. Gotcha. You have to accept that. You have to be humble in your craft and not pretend like you're better than you are. I'm pretty good, but there's people who are better than me.
Okay, but hard to be humble, especially when you're as great as you are, David. But hard to be humble. Jamie, I will give a specific example for Jamie and see if he's experienced anything like this. So Jamie and I have known each other for 1,000 years, Lee, and worked together at the Pentagon. And long story short, when something was really big in the news, it might have been right in the wake of 9/11, it might have been Iraq, and in my day, the Pentagon had the hands down the best press corps in the world. Serious people who knew their stuff. No, Jamie, you know this. They serious people who knew their stuff, and you didn't always agree with them, but you know they knew their stuff and you could work with them. Great. And then when something was in the news a lot, it always, like once every 2 or 3 weeks, you get a call. It usually was a network, Jamie. And they'd say, you know, big muckety muck anchor with a lot of blow dried hair is going to come in and spend a few weeks at the Pentagon. It's like, oh, really? And it was always obnoxious and it always disrupted things. But Jamie, have you experienced this? Have you experienced what Boston experienced with Sylvia Plath?
Well, so, you know, there's a word for this, the people seem to fall into one of two categories. And and of course, the word that applies to probably David and me is this, you know, imposter syndrome, where you've gotten a lot of accolades and success, and you don't actually think you're kind of faking it. And then there's a overconfidence syndrome, which is the people who come in and believe they know everything. And people sort of fall into one category or another. And generally, the more competent people are suffering from imposter syndrome, where they are slightly insecure and thinking they're not really up to what they're supposed to be doing. And there's lots of other better people, but they're doing the best they can. Yeah. And I certainly felt like I kind of felt like that. I felt like I had succeeded well beyond my actual abilities. Whereas I also saw other people who also succeeded well beyond their actual abilities, but had no clue.
It's a version of when John McCain first got to Congress, he had a great line. And he says, when you first get to Congress, you spend the first 6 months going, oh my God, how did I get here? And then you spend the next 6 months going, how did all these other idiots get here? Okay. Lee, put on your psychology hat. Diagnose Sylvia Plath.
Sylvia Plath. Oh, well, that's
DSM-5, baby. I know DSM-5.
You want to? We can go there. We can totally go there.
Go DSM-5.
Well, I can tell you, she had bipolar 1. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, bipolar 1, and bipolar 1 with comorbid depression, normal depression on top of that. But I'll tell you, you know what we see with bipolar 1 is mania. Well, I should say, actually, if I'm really thinking about it, bipolar 2. I take it back. Bipolar 2 because she had hypomania, which is, if you're reading the bell jar, that's what's so amazing about it. You're reading, you know, about halfway through the bell jar, she is hospitalized for trying to kill herself.
Right.
And that's where, general readers will go, wow, she's having a mental breakdown. It's time for her to go away. But the truth is, on page one, she is having a hypomanic episode. And it goes on for months. And so everything that we see is slightly skewed, slightly heightened, slightly sort of, there's no emotional grounding. She's seeing all of these things happen and all these things are happening to her, things that would absolutely be terrifying. She gets food poisoning. She's overworked. And there is never a moment where she goes, boy, I am tired. I'm depressed. I'm stressed. It is more just sort of happening almost like outside of her. And that's done on purpose because that's what hypomania is. It's seeing the world through this sort of highly pressurized, sort of heightened way. And then what happens is you've got a depressive drop. And it doesn't just go to depression. It goes to deep, deep depression. And that's what Sylvia had. And if you start to read her letters, you know, she comes out of McLean Hospital better. There's electroconvulsive shock therapy. There's other forms of treatment that Dr. Barnhouse worked with her on. She comes out a whole complete person. Not that she wasn't before, but the mental illness has sort of been tamped down. She goes for the next couple of years with slightly manic episodes. And then by the end, when her husband leaves her, or she leaves her husband for cheating on her, her children are sick. She's in a country removed from everybody that she knows. It's freezing. She doesn't have any heat and she has no phone hooked up. She's isolated. That all of a sudden you start to, and you read her letters at this point, it is someone who is spiraling, not just hovering over depression, but in a deep, intractable sort of just in depression. And that's where we really worry. When I was a practitioner, if I saw that, the first thing I would do is consider hospitalizing somebody.
Right.
Because that is where we start to really worry about people who are hopeless and see no way out.
Right. Okay. David, I know you've got a scoot.
Well,
Any last questions?
I wanted to ask Lee this because fascinated is not the right word. Someone who wrote something as impactful as The Bell Jar, I just always wonder, you've been immersed in her head, I think, right? A while now. Where do you fall on, should we be grateful that we got something as consequential as The Bell Jar out of her, or should we be disappointed that we never got anything more than that? I'm always wondering where my brain should lay in that sort of argument.
I think, first of all, what a beautiful question. No one has ever asked it quite like that. I thought you were going somewhere else with that. And I'm glad you asked that way. Obviously, I think we should be very incredibly grateful that this came out, but also incredibly sad because there could have been a lot more. And I'll tell you, that's where the mystery sort of comes. There's a gaping hole when somebody dies by suicide, especially at a very young age. And we fill that hole with a myth of who she could have been and who she even really was. I discovered her poetry at a much older age. I mean, I had read her stuff, but I didn't fall in love with it till much later. I wish there was more. I know, but I think gratefulness is good. Is the answer. But I'll tell you where I thought you were going was, is there a link between her madness? Should we be grateful that she had madness?
Isn't that the age old question, madness and genius?
There are studies about this because I was doing prep before I came onto these shows. I was like, someone's going to ask me this question.
I think I sent you an email, Lee, saying no prep necessary.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. Obviously I didn't listen. The idea though is, okay, so is there a connection between madness and art? And, the studies show actually no, except for one scenario. And the scenario is bipolar disorder. Oddly enough, it's bipolar. And I think it has to do with the fact that bipolar is one of the few sort of disorders in the DSM-5 where we actually have coherent madness, coherent mania. You talk about schizophrenia, or you talk about, those sort of manic breaks, that's not coherent.
Right. With
bipolar disorder, it is hyper everything. It's sort of like Charlie Sheen going crazy and doing all these drugs and living life, outwardly in a manic state.
Mm-hmm.
But people who sort of take that and sort of channel it into some creative endeavor. That seems to happen a lot with bipolar disorder. I will say though, as a writer and any sort of creative, I think that there is sort of an understood madness when you start to create, because there's no other way to sort of explain how you can legitimately have a conversation with characters that don't exist in scenarios that only happen in your head without in some way, shape or form thinking, well, I'm sort of crazy as I'm going through this. But, somebody who's suffering from bipolar disorder, it is a tough place to find yourself.
So how would you diagnose your own mental disorder?
My own personal mental disorder?
That you're so creative.
Oh, my goodness. I would absolutely say I am perpetually stuck in mania. Like, and nobody understands me. I used to think that people were just being nice to me. But generally, I'm constantly in my own head. If I turn my camera, you would see notes everywhere. And it's been that way since I was a little kid. Just sort of in my own world. It's a wonder I'm able to actually tie my own shoes. But if you go back to even the very first thing we were talking about, how people sort of, there's always people who are better than you. I've been doing this for a long time, and I feel very, very grateful that I'm able to actually call myself a novelist now, because it's taken a long time to get here. But I remember being in the fifth grade, and I wrote my first short story that won an award. And I was in Texas. I lived in Texas. And so I wrote this story, the short story that won this national award through Bantam Books.
Wow. What was it called and what was it about?
God, it was, you're going to laugh. I mean, because not all my stories are like this. It was actually, it was called something like Friends or something simple like that, but it was told from the point of view of a young girl. So, but it totally, and I win this award. I won $50 from Bantam Books and a certificate. And my grandfather, who was very loving and very supportive of my writing career, but what I wanted to be my aspirations, comes over to me and says, Lee, I'm very proud of you, but always remember there is always somebody better than you, and that's okay. And wow. And it was just awesome. A very wise thing to say at 11 years old.
Okay. So cool. Is that a lesson you really need to learn in 10th grade?
Listen, no, Texas is
10th grade.
It rough and tumble. I mean, you do not mess around in Texas. It's a scary place. I mean, I grew up there. My grandfather was like, yeah, man, you know, this is how life is going to be. If you're going to be a writer, you got to know that, and he was a creative guy too. So he knew what he was talking about.
All right. All right. Let's get you out with this on the Last Confessions of Sylvia P. If we hadn't gone on so long about Ukraine, which I could do forever, we would have been talking about, there's an interesting New York Times story recently about fiction writers and addressing COVID. Do you write about it? Do you not write about it? Is it too soon? These kinds of things. If Sylvia Plath had lived beyond 30 and she were living today, how in her work would she address the pandemic?
I think she would have gone really internal. I think she would have spoken about her own personal struggles with depression and isolation. She does it so beautifully. What's amazing about her is she wrote about this stuff 60 years ago, and it is still so relevant today. You could open up any one of her poems, and it might as well be talking about what it had been like living through COVID.
Yeah. Is that what makes her so relevant still today?
Oh, without a doubt.
It just transcended time, correct? Her work just transcended time.
Well, the funny thing is, I mean, I don't know if it's funny, but so depressive thoughts, thoughts of anxiety, thoughts of, death, thoughts of hurting other people because you're so angry. These sorts of things, alienation, even things that are even, you still aren't really supposed to talk about, like sex and in a very public way, and lust and all these things. These are things that everybody has felt since the dawn of time. But she was the first person to come out and actually start to talk about them in a way that was accessible to other people. And the reason I think it's so universal is because we're still human today and we all still relate to all the things she was talking about.
Yeah.
She was able to cut through the noise and put it out there in a way that I think few people today can even do.
You admire her?
Oh, yeah.
I know. I'm listening to what you're saying. I'm thinking, as I said, as we introduced you, I just think you're so gutsy to have tackled this topic. And she was incredibly gutsy. Now, her mental condition may have fueled that, but she's incredibly gutsy. Lee Kravitz, the book, again, you're so gutsy. I am so glad you're gutsy because the book is fabulous. Really, really fabulous. And thank you. This is the beginning of your tour, right?
This is it.
This podcast will be up tomorrow, March 8th. And
we're very sorry.
Are you kidding me? Guys, this is great. I actually, you know what? Before I walked in here, I was like, this is the beginning. This is it. This is the inaugural conversation. So,
and we have to thank Jane Byrne, the wonderful Jane Byrne at HarperCollins, who introduced me to Lee. And I said, we'll be good to him because it'll be early in the tour. Because that's
exactly what we Jane need. Is wonderful. I love Jane.
She's fabulous.
Gary, I know we're running out of time, but can I just say one thing in defense of journalism schools?
Can I yell in your ear, rap?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'll see if I can do this in 38 seconds.
Okay,
so former adjunct.
Okay, rap, Jamie.
Which is, hey, and we're out of time. an adjunct professor is just somebody who's a low-paid freelancer who taught journalism. Lee is absolutely right. I just want to say this to aspiring journalists out there. You don't need to go to journalism school to be a journalist, but that doesn't mean it can't help, because not everybody's as fortunate to know as early on what they want to do as Lee is. And as somebody who has not just one but two useless journalism degrees, I think it can really sometimes just help you get that first job, that first break, which you need to sometimes get in. And also gives you a chance to learn things like law of mass communications and ethics and some other stuff you never have time to talk about in the newsroom. So
nicely done.
Anyway,
I agree. I would never give up my 4 years at Mizzou. Not even for a second. I completely agree.
All right, Lee Kravitz, the book is Last Confessions of Sylvia P. It is wonderful. Everybody, thank you for listening. Download us, review us nicely. We are back next week with Chris Herring, author of Blood in the Garden. Fabulous book about the New York Knicks. You may not like basketball. You may not care about New York, but it is a fabulous book. Chris Herring, we like David, right? You know Chris Herring?
No, I like him. Yes.
Excellent. We have him next week. Claude, thank you for making everything happen. JB, David, thanks for being with us. Go AU. Lee, great to meet you. Hope you come back.
I will be back anytime. Thanks, guys. Thanks
and we're out. We're out.